Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Podalters. How are you doing? It's been a very long time no speak, but I'm so pleased to be back with season 10 of Adulting. Wow. It was the 3-year anniversary of the podcast the other day, and it's really exciting how far we've come. In fact, I think today's conversation with Matt Haig is quite reflective of that. We sort of start to push back a little against the pervasiveness and negative aspects of woke culture, for want of a better phrase. And that's certainly a theme this season, which is interesting to reflect on because I guess this podcast is all about becoming more knowledgeable and less ignorant. But I wonder if more broadly as a society and on social media, if maybe we're losing sight of that very important goal and it's kind of turned into something else. So this season, I'm still asking people what three things they wish they'd been taught in school. And Matt's are philosophy, coping with adversity, and self-acceptance. I should say as well, his book, The Midnight Library, which I absolutely loved, is also now out in paperback in case you're looking for your next read. I really hope you enjoy listening, and I am so glad to be back. Bye. Hello and welcome to Adulting. Today I'm joined by Matt Haig.
Hello, it's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on. When I emailed you, I told you this, but I very recently read The Midnight Library and it was just one of the most uplifting things I could have done at such a difficult time. So thank you so much for writing such an incredible book. I loved it.
Oh, well, that's very, very kind of you to say. And thank you. Yes, it was. I never really know what to. I'm very bad at dealing with compliments, but that's very, very nice to hear.
So how are you doing anyway? I mean, we just had the news that we know when things are maybe going to finally start opening up. So how are you feeling at the minute? It's a bit of change and shift of gear, I guess.
Yes, I'm feeling optimistic, which is a rare feeling these days. I'm feeling quite good. I mean, it might just be because the sun is shining. We were again speaking about this, but the sun is shining in Brighton and it probably shouldn't be as it's February, but it's a very glorious day. And I've got a feeling of optimism, which isn't the normal feeling these days. I'm feeling quite good about the world and everything. And all is sort of, well, I still feel like we're in the tunnel, but I feel like I can cope with things so long as I've got a sense of like the future being a bit better. And I think for once we've got a sense of that. It might maybe a false sense, but at the moment things seem to be heading back to, if not normality, then some kind of better place.
Definitely. It definitely feels like we've got something to look forward to, at least, which, as you say, is not what we've been feeling more recently. But I'm sure everyone will already know who you are. But if people don't, could you give us an introduction to Matt Haig, who you are and what you do?
I'm primarily a writer. I've written lots of things. I've written fiction like The Midnight Library, which you just mentioned, but also non-fiction. I wrote a book about my own experience of mental health, depression, anxiety, panic disorder, the whole sort of smorgasbord of my mental illness. I wrote in a book called Reasons to Stay Alive 5 or 6 years ago. And I've written another book about mental health called Notes on a Nervous Planet. I've got another one coming out called The Comfort Book, which isn't really about mental health, but more sort of philosophical. And I've written lots of children's books, like A Boy Called Christmas. And I've written lots of other novels like How to Stop Time and the Humans. So I spend most of my life writing. I'm occasionally, sometimes I'm introduced as like mental health advocate, but I don't really see myself as an advocate, partly because I feel a bit too lazy and disorganized to be an advocate or an ambassador for any particular cause. But I do spend a lot of my time, I mean, even Midnight Library refers to mental health a lot, and it covers topics like suicide and depression and stuff. But I don't really see myself as an advocate. I'm just someone who writes about it because I think about it a lot because I have my own experiences of mental health. So I always stick to the description of writer, really, though often that's broadened into something else. But I feel comfortable just being myself on a laptop, writing whatever is in my head. And that's my sort of comfort place.
I know that Reasons to Stay Alive has been an absolutely roaring success. And I think everyone that I know brings it up at some point and talks about it as this book that really is life-changing. And I'm sure it's had such a big impact. I know you said you hate compliments, but how did that feel, I guess, when you took something so personal, so traumatic, and I guess so vulnerable, and then turned it into this piece of work, which now has gone on to have a life of its own? Would you ever have imagined that to have come from that? It's kind of amazing in lots of ways.
Well, no, definitely not. And for lots of reasons, it was a very surprising book, Reasons to Stay Alive, because, firstly, I very nearly didn't write it. It was the only book I ever wrote, and it was that I'd been asked to write. This was like book number 10, but the first nonfiction book I'd ever written. And it's because a friend who'd read a blog of mine, I did this one-off blog called Reasons to Stay Alive, which was the first time ever on the internet or publicly I'd spoken about my own experience of mental health. I wrote this sort of tiny 200-word piece or 400-word piece called Reasons to Stay Alive. And she said, oh, you should turn that into a book. You should do a book about it. And I thought, you know, I didn't know. I didn't have a clue how to do that. And she said, oh, I've got this good, you know, contact with publisher who'd be right for it, which we didn't end up going with. I went with my sort of normal publisher in the end, but my normal publisher, they weren't that excited about it. They said, turn it into a novel. I said, no, I think it needs to be, if I'm going to write about mental health and my story, I'd rather not fictionalize it. I'd rather do it as me, because that'll have more of an impact with people who are in a similar situation, because they'll feel like they can relate to it and someone else has been through it. So I had to hold my ground, and they said, okay, that's fine. You know, we won't give you as much money as the last book, or if you were writing a novel, but yes, you know, we'll publish it. And then I had to work out how I'm writing it, and whether it's a memoir, whether it was a self-help book. So I had to kind of invent a kind of new kind of book that I wanted to just put everything into. And so it was a series of sort of accidents and little left turns that led to it happening. But no, there was definitely no expectation from even me or the publisher that it would be what, you know, became up to that point my biggest book, that would sort of resonate with people, that would find, you know, because I felt like I was writing for a very small readership of people who are very much in an equivalent place. But what was the surprising thing about Reasons to Stay Alive is a lot of the people, if not most of the people who read that book, weren't people who'd been suicidal, or they were just people who either had gone through something themselves, or who knew someone and they wanted to understand that person better, whether it was their son or daughter or sibling or partner or friend. They wanted to actually know what that feeling is like behind that invisible facade. So, yeah. It was a surprise, is what I'm saying. And it happened very organically. It happened very naturally. It was a real kind of slow burn, word of mouth thing. You know, I had a few lucky media breaks with radio and stuff, but nothing spectacular. There wasn't much telly or anything. But it just became this sort of word of mouth thing, which was really quite lovely, but also quite intimidating in a way. Because obviously, as a struggling writer, you want to have your big breakthrough. You have your number one bestseller and stuff. But because it was that book, I suddenly felt incredibly exposed. And I was like, no, I'm a novelist. I write novels. And then, you know, this was my side project. My side project had become a main project. And then suddenly, as I was talking earlier about being called mental health ambassador and advocate, I was called that. I never called myself it, but I'd written this book about mental health. So I inevitably got called it, and people would contact me as if I was a Samaritans, and I'd hear from kind of ill people a lot, or vulnerable people a lot. And I struggled with that side of it very much for a while. There was even a period where I would have actually pressed the button to not have written it, because I didn't feel like I could cope with the responsibility. I felt like from that point on, I had to act a certain way or represent a cause in a certain way, which I didn't feel up to. And it took me a long time, really, to actually get to the point where I accepted it, and I accepted my own imperfections and the book's own imperfections, and I could just sort of deal with it. But yeah, I mean, speaking now, I'm actually very glad I wrote it. And, you know, I don't think it's my best book, but it's probably the book that I'm most proud of in some ways, because it's been useful to people. So yeah.
It's amazing in seeing how much general discourse and conversation around mental health has happened and changed in those last 5 years, especially this understanding of, as you're saying, the people reading Reasons to Stay Alive may not be someone who suffers with a diagnosed mental illness, but there's been this real recognition of everyone having mental health and people who suffer from mental illness, and those things kind of coexisting all the time. And I guess in this moment as well with COVID, we're really starting to get an even better understanding perhaps of the fact that no matter who you are, no matter what your starting point is with your mental health, there's always room for deviation. And I guess the reason so many people would have wanted to come and speak to you is at that time when Reasons to Stay Alive came out, just people weren't speaking about it. And I can imagine how easy it would be for people to go, oh, he's the mental illness guy now, because there were so few voices, but there just wasn't enough normalization of it. And how do you feel that's changed, I guess, now? Do you feel like there's so much more room for people to kind of dip in and out of talking about mental health without it becoming their entire identity?
Yeah, it's massively changed. Obviously, we're still in the midst of a mental health crisis, so there's not been any magic wand wave. We're only just beginning to start to realise how this last year plus has impacted our mental health in terms of COVID and lockdowns and, you know, all the stuff that came with that. So we are definitely not out of the woods in terms of a mental health crisis. But in terms of recognising the problem has improved massively in the last 5 years or so. And it was great to be part of that conversation. What's interesting, though, is how quickly things have shifted. Like now, for instance, now, it really depends, because I think like there's a lot of people out there, and I'm thinking now possibly more about male people than female people, I don't know, but there's still people out there who still find it very hard to talk about their own mental health. So I think there's a risk sometimes in saying, yes, you know, we're all having a mental health conversation, because obviously if you're sort of in any kind of media world, or if you're on social media a lot, it feels like everyone's talking about mental health. But, you know, for the reality of, I don't know, a taxi driver in Glasgow who's 50-year-old and or whatever, but there's definite large swathes of society that are still where we kind of always were. I mean, for instance, you only have to look at like the suicide figures to realize that most people who died by suicide, I mean, I'm not being gender specific here, it's like across the board, most people who died by suicide haven't actually contacted anyone professional about their mental health. And so I see that statistic, and I see a lot of potentially preventable deaths that are caused by silence and a stigma that's still there. So I feel like, yes, in one sense, we're definitely having a conversation, but it's how we're having that conversation, who's involved with the conversation, and you know, how inclusive in the very broader sense we're being about that. So I'm always a little bit where we definitely are. It's definitely, mental health talks about a lot, celebrities talk about it a lot, it's used a lot in magazines, and we see it a lot on Instagram. But I feel like a lot of people still have an issue with articulating their own mental health experience, or, you know, just think. And often we'll be talking about mental health while at the same time stigmatizing it. For instance, like a magazine will talk about, I can remember being on a train a year or so ago, and Closer magazine, well, it must have been over a year ago because I haven't been on a train since 2019, but I was on a train and there was a copy of Closer magazine. And Closer magazine, I know it's Closer magazine, so you don't expect, you know. But anyway, they had an article about, I think it was something like Geordie Shore Confessions. And the confessions was just two people from Geordie Shore who were talking about that they once had panic attacks and depression. It's like, you know, that, you know, it shouldn't be a scandalous thing. It shouldn't be a confession that you're talking about you once had a panic attack. So I think, you know, there's talking about it and talking about it in a way that's actually meaningful and destigmatized.
Yeah, you're so right. Also, I've got such a bad habit of thinking about everything in terms of what happens on Twitter. And I think it's definitely exacerbated because we're in the pandemic when we're not actually out and about. And I actually need to get out of my like Twitter social media brain and into the reality of the world.
Oh, God, yeah.
it's not helpful. But yeah, I think you're right. And oh, sorry.
No, I was going to say I had a really rough time on Twitter, partly my own fault, in January. And again, I was being judged because I was like, people see me as mental health ambassador and I don't necessarily. So I do something and then got into a pickle. And now I've actually, what the thing I've done in that context was I'd used the word psychotic in the wrong context. And a Twitter storm happened. I felt like the whole world was sort of caving in on me. And obviously it's not. It's just a Twitter thing for that day. And then I just decided I'm never going to have an opinion on Twitter again. I'm just not going to put any opinion on there. So I've literally stepped away from Twitter, apart from, you know, I'll obviously announce when my paperback comes out or this, that, and the other comes out. But other than a promotional tool, I don't use Twitter as a sort of normal person now because it was impacting my mental health. Because you get to a point and you get to a, especially if you have quite a few followers, where it just makes you so neurotic. And I find it so ironic, really, that people, you know, who would claim to be sort of caring and on side about mental health have no hesitation at all about instigating pile-ons or this, that, and that. There must be a better way to progress as a human species than just by shaming people. Or, you know, there's a, I won't bombard you with old quotes, but there's a, I think it was Plato, or one of those ancient Greek philosophers said, you know, for progress to happen, you need to debate ideas, not people. So you don't attack the person, you attack something that they represent. But I feel like we're now in the opposite world where it's always just about shaming someone or whatever. And I just find that mentally, personally unhealthy. But I think it's unhealthy for us as a society. So I've stepped back a bit from Twitter. I know Instagram has its problems too, but I feel like I'm more of an Instagram person these days.
Yeah, it's awful. And so many people are having to step away from these platforms now. And I think there's this weird thing. I think part of it is lockdown. I do think there's this really heightened sense of urgency with this kind of people really kind of going for it, like kind of baying for blood online when they really want, they want kind of some result or resolution from something someone's done, but it leaves no room for error. And I agree with what you're saying about audiences and following. I think there's this idea of kind of punching up and punching down. And once you become someone of certain fame or you have a certain amount of followers, I do think people start to think you're kind of invincible. And in that sense, you then are you kind of susceptible to being ridiculed or whatever. And as you say, like often, if obviously someone's saying really abhorrent things, if it's like Katie Hopkins, I mean, like she's kind of, yeah, it's what she's saying is awful. But I do completely agree. Like when someone says something where it's quite obviously you might have got it slightly wrong, we've just got no space to go, oh, did you know that actually I wouldn't have said that if I were you, could put it this way. It turns into kind of like not only virtue signaling, but I think we all want to be seen as doing the right thing. So some of that is actually a response of fear of thinking, crap, if I don't call this out, will I get called out? And it's turned into a really weird, like you said, it's definitely a neuroses online. It's weird.
Yes, I think that there's a lot of fear and a lot of anger and a lot of confusion and a lot of people who get frustrated. Like, for instance, what I've noticed, if you became someone's idea of representing a thing, so say someone saw me, for instance, as representing mental health or a certain way of talking about mental health or the mental health debate, any issues they have with that topic then become channeled towards you as an individual person. And so they're not really seeing you as an individual, they're seeing you as representing or signifying something about the issue. I see it online with, say, COVID. You know, so you get an expert versus expert in public health in Edinburgh who's been quite pro lockdown or something, and she gets Debbie Shidra is her name, and she gets all kinds of abuse. And it's obviously not personal. I mean, it is to her because they're being personal about her, but it's about their frustrations with lockdown or frustrations with COVID. And then if you're the person who's stuck your head over the parapet, you get all of that. You get all the tomatoes smashed in your face like you're in the public stocks. But what I find interesting about mental health, when people do it about mental health or say that you're talking about, it's like, well, if you're someone who's sharing your own mental health experience because you experience mental illness sometimes, and one of the symptoms of mental illness is you're not always quite acting like your best self, you know. So it's okay you saying you're absolutely brilliant with mental health and you want this stigma-free world for mental health. Yet anyone who deviates their behavior from like the perfect finishing school of Twitter, where you know how to act and you know which causes to support at which time, and you never get a hashtag wrong and you do everything perfectly, well, that's just not real life. That's not just not humanity, and that's certainly not mental illness. You know, the thing about mental illness is you sometimes do stuff because your esteem is so low, or you tweet something wrong, or you say something wrong that you're not necessarily deeply thinking about. You're just sort of, I don't know, you're just sort of lost in the maze. So I feel like there needs to be more forgiveness all around. And I include myself in this because I've been terribly judgmental online before, you know, certainly on political things. Like I always used to say, well, you know, if it's a politician, they're kind of in the firing line anyway. But I'm even wondering now if that's really a justification, because there's always got to be a cleverer way to advance a cause than to just go after attacking a person, because what I feel that does is it just entrenches both sides. And I feel a lot of people online, certainly on Twitter, and it's not everybody, but I see it a lot. There's a lot of performative outrage where someone will go after someone, not to win anyone on the other side over at all, not to bring on anyone new in, but merely to sort of get the applause and the likes from their own side of the argument. And I don't get the point of that. It just seems that seems deliberately divisive and performative, and more about Twitter approval than it is about advancing any social cause.
Well, I think the fundamental issue is because... Oh, sorry, that was a great rant, and I completely agree, especially about attacking the individual. I've had the same kind of realization. And I think the problem fundamentally is because everything is online, we've forgotten what it means to kind of rally together and to get people on side. And so it does just become this kind of like, how woke can I be, I guess, and with no kind of real end. And also going back to what you were saying about the mental health thing, which I think is really interesting, in terms of what you were saying before about, you know, certain members of the public or certain people in society not having this deep understanding of mental health, it's because the mental health representation that we do get maybe will be about anxiety or depression, and it will be about people that are presented as not the victims of their illness, but are really like disadvantaged by it. Whereas sometimes mental illness presents in really horrible behavior or things that we don't want to champion. And so people might not recognize that their negative traits actually stem from something which they could perhaps try and deal with. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm wording that right.
Yeah, no, totally. I feel like, you know, we're okay about mental illness as a topic, but as a reality, if things like self-harm, and I'm not just talking about physical health harm, self-sabotage that can happen, which can happen in ugly ways. There's alcoholism, there's addiction that's related to mental health issues. There is, you know, certain conditions, certain types of depression, even straightforward depression, you know, straightforward depression, it's never straightforward, but even depression and anxiety themselves, you can often act in ways which confuse or trouble other people. You know, I lost a lot of friends through my depression years because I was I wasn't explaining what I was feeling, but I was acting in ways that were just confusing, or I didn't want to see them. I couldn't go to the pub. I couldn't do this because I was feeling agoraphobic. I couldn't go out to a nightclub in Nottingham or whatever it was. So I lost a lot of people that way. So I feel a hell of a lot of online stuff, but maybe real life stuff as well, is just misunderstanding. And yeah, in terms of mental health, I feel like there's a lot, you know, we all know that we're meant to be on, I suppose it's like any issue like environmentalism or racism or anything. We all know what we're meant to say and what we're meant to think and how to say it. But actually in reality of how we change things or make things better, I think that's what we're still struggling with.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think that, I mean, whether or not once we emerge from this kind of enforced lockdown, whether or not that will strengthen community bonds, and if it will actually make some of this kind of internet created polarization that you were talking about earlier, whether that will actually change once we've realized now the importance of kind of real life community and conversation. I don't know if that will have some kind of, I'd love for it to have some kind of incredible impact on the way that we learn to kind of relate to each other, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's reasons to be optimistic and reasons to be pessimistic about that. I swing between the two. I feel in some ways it has, I mean, there's nothing, you know, a virus, it literally shows how humans are connected. You know, it's so easy in our sort of privileged Western societies to feel like you have an individualistic sense of the world, and even a lot of our self-help talk is very individualistic about self-acceptance and self-empowerment. But we really see how connected we are to other selves in a pandemic, for good and for bad. And, you know, that can lead to a lot of falling out, you know, where you get maskers versus anti-maskers, or pro-vaccination people are against anti-vaxxers, or whatever it is. There's a lot of divisiveness there. But there's also, I think, at a deep level, a sense that we are a species. We are human beings together facing this threat, which crosses gender lines, which crosses nationalities, crosses races. You know, we may not be all in the same boat, obviously, but we are facing this same storm. And so in that deep sense, I think it has psychologically forced us to think of ourselves as fellow human beings a bit more, hopefully.
I love that, because that actually leads on very well to the first thing you were taught in school, which is you wish that you had been taught philosophy. And I feel like that was a very philosophical take on this moment in time. So when did you first come across philosophy as a topic? Did you learn anything about it in school, or is it something you came across later in life?
I mean, I know there is such a thing as like a philosophy GCSE and philosophy A-level, but I never took them, and was never in my sort of ordinary state school in the Midlands. No, that wasn't on the curriculum. It wasn't on the menu to do philosophy. The first time I came across philosophy was actually when I was doing an English and history degree at Hull University. And it wasn't my degree. It was, I did a master's degree in English at Leeds after my degree in Hull. And I did a course on critical theory, which was, it's just the most obscure sort of modern, postmodern philosophy. Lots of French philosophers talking in very difficult language. And it put me totally off the idea of philosophy. And it was really when I was after university, as a writer, reading up on stuff for books and things, I got seriously into philosophy. And philosophy has particularly helped me during lockdown and during this sort of pandemic era. I've been listening to lots of philosophy podcasts and reading a lot about ancient Greek philosophy, Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, which is, as well as a religion, it's also a philosophy too. And I feel like a more philosophical approach to life, a more thoughtful approach to life, would lead to a bit of a calmer world. Obviously, there's different types of philosophy and stuff like that. But I feel like we've lost the art of thinking about stuff. We're always arguing about stuff. We're always debating stuff. But it's from a position which we've already arrived at. And I feel like we don't actually keep our minds open enough, because the ancient Greeks loved the idea of debate and dialogues. In fact, like when Plato, famous Greek philosopher Plato, was writing his works of philosophy, they always took the form of dialogues. So they were like Twitter conversations, essentially. But unlike Twitter conversations, it was two people reasoning and out-reasoning with each other, not insulting each other, but trying to sort of work out and progress ideas forward. And we've seen that I feel like people now are sometimes don't know how to handle any and I include myself again in this, you know, we're challenged when any person with a different view comes along. We even think, well, you're either on our side or you're against our side, and of course that's not the nature of reality. And human beings, you know, always progress ideas, and they never think what human beings thought a century previously. But right now we almost feel like we've got to arrive at the end of morality, and we know exactly what the good thing is and the bad thing is, and it's this. And I think a bit more of ambiguity and a bit more critical thinking and a bit more doubt. You know, philosophy is almost like the opposite of religion or faith, because philosophy is totally open. It's about putting a question mark after everything. It's about, you know, questioning your own thoughts. And it can be very therapeutic too, because, you know, if, say, you're stuck with depression gives you loads of bleak certainty. Whereas if you sort of become a bit more mindful about it, a bit more philosophical about it, you'll realize that everything's unstable and actually open to interpretation. And as soon as you realize that, you realize that you could have a new interpretation of yourself or of what you're going through. And I feel like we need it. And also in terms of like progress, like we love the idea of progress as humans, and we always think we're progressing. But so often that means technological progress, because, you know, we're in this world now where, you know, an Xbox becomes 10 times more powerful in terms of processing power every 10 years, where social media is advancing ever more. You know, we've got all these great apps which can do all these sort of clever things and increasingly clever things. We're heading towards a world of sort of permanent virtuality, but we're not actually changing as human beings. We're just, our technology and our world around us is changing. So I feel like philosophy, we need more philosophy and more thought about what all this is doing to us, because so often we'll be engaged in like a political squabble or I don't know, whatever sort of discourse online, without actually taking a deep step back of how we're arriving at our things and how much, say, for instance, in an argument on Twitter, I very rarely see people step back and say, actually, is Twitter making us have this row? We're rowing on Twitter. This is Twitter's service, and we're just being the Twitter product by having a row. So I think like we definitely need more deep thinking about where we are. And I think that one of the problem is people think philosophy is this big, abstract, difficult subject, because it sort of became that towards the end of the 20th century. But if you go back to like Socrates, Plato, ancient Greeks, ancient Stoics like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, all these guys, they spoke in very simple aphorisms and sentences about life. And they have a lot to say about us now. For instance, cognitive behavioral therapy, which has only been around since the 1970s, really, 1960s it was first sort of come up with. Cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the most mainstream type of talk therapy you would get, say, on the NHS in the UK. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, that started because of an ancient Greek guy called Epictetus, because the founders of CBT, whose names I've forgotten, but the psychologists who founded CBT, they were inspired by the ancient Greek Stoic philosophers like Epictetus, who himself was a slave, who was in pain a lot of his life. But his whole approach was, you know, it's not, we have no control over external events, but what we do control is our responses to the external events. So that's a very simple thought. And it's a thought that's lasted for nearly 3,000 years through philosophy into modern day therapy. And so I find, you know, philosophy is like root therapy. It's like the core essence of thought and ideas and how we can sort of change and keep our minds open. So yeah, more philosophy.
That's so fascinating to think about. As you're talking about it, it's something I've been thinking about more. I think we really police our thoughts because we're so scared again of this like mob mentality of getting it wrong. So there was a period of time where I wouldn't even read an article or like a piece of work if I thought that the person might have like different political views from me, as if it was going to, what, like corrupt me. I don't know. It was like a weird thing where I couldn't even possibly read this piece because it was in the Times. I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. And yeah, Now I'm like, how pathetic is that? Like, what good does that do us if we can't think on our own? And I used to find myself as well, I would form an opinion and then I'd wait and see if the other people that I kind of agree with or look up to agreed. And then once they kind of signaled that they did, I'd be like, yeah, me too. It's like, God, we've actually lost the ability to just kind of go, do you know what, this is what I think, because we are, I think, like you said earlier, it's that fear of you know, being cancelled or whatever it is. I don't know. It's not helpful.
No, it's not helpful. I noticed it the other day. Obviously, I'm a writer, so I have to expect bad reviews, and that's part of the territory. But I saw an interesting one the other day where they said, I really liked this book when I first read it, but after reading reviews online, which chimes with my experience, I've decided I don't like the book. And I was like, are you being that led by, you know, that distrusting of your own opinion that you've got to take so many social cues from other people to actually... So I thought that was interesting. But I feel like that. I also feel like it actually weakens our position rather than strengthens it, because it's kind of like resistance training. You need to test your ideas out. Your ideas don't actually become weaker. If they're good ideas, they don't become weaker when they're challenged or when you surround yourself with other thoughts. They become, stronger. You know, when Karl Marx was writing Das Kapital and stuff, he was surrounding himself in the works of capitalism, like Adam Smith and stuff, and getting a lot of stuff out of that, and they're getting a lot of information about that to formulate his own views. Ideas don't live in isolation, you know, just as people don't live in isolation, and we need to read other stuff, even stuff you don't agree with. And when I was, for a brief while, I was a wannabe screenwriter, and I was told, don't just read good scripts. Don't just read scripts of films you like. Read scripts of films that you don't like and work out what is wrong with those scripts. Work out why that didn't work. And I feel like we don't always have to read stuff that we're totally fans of or in line with, because, yes, there's a comfort to that because it helps us feel like we've got an identity and a tribe and all of that, but it doesn't actually help the ideas we have themselves at all, because they're never challenged. And you need that resistance challenge. You need to sort of pick up that weight and still hold it. And yeah, we've lost a bit of that, and I'll agree, I have as well. And I think part of it is because we're so swamped with information that, you know, we can't get through all the information we want to read, let alone the stuff we don't want to read. But I feel like it is, you know, it's important, for instance, when you're getting the news. Like, I used to just always get my news solely from The Guardian. And now I just, as much as I like The Guardian, it's got a clear political objective. Not every writer for The Guardian thinks the same things, but editorially, there's a type of news it focuses on and a type of news it doesn't focus on. And even something as superficially objective as the BBC still has a kind of editorial agenda. So it helps to just have I'll dip into the Telegraph or wherever to, and it won't be stuff I necessarily agree with, but it's important to know what the other side's saying. Because occasionally, you know, not most people, most intelligent people aren't wrong 100% of the time. There's normally some value you can get from someone who doesn't think exactly of you, or even if you're disagreeing with them, you might be disagreeing with them in a new way. So there's always something you can get out of reading or listening to other people. And I do that with podcasts sometimes. Like, sometimes there'll be someone who I'm quite well, I dare say there might be someone listening to this who's annoyed by me, but I sometimes listen to something thinking, well, I don't really like this person, but I'd be still quite interested to see why I don't like this person or how I don't like this person. So yeah, I feel like we need to have a bit more open ears to different things, basically.
No, I agree. I feel like there's this weird, almost like puritanical sense to those of us that maybe would consider us to be quite liberal, where we're kind of self-censoring, and it feels quite religious in an odd way to be like, oh my God, I can't touch this piece of whatever it is. And I it's only like recently, I think, because the like polarization, everything is getting so heightened that actually it's getting to this point of, it's been thrown into such a sharp relief that you're starting to think, wow, this discourse or whatever it is getting so far the other way that we're obviously going about something wrong. Like, as you said earlier about it stopped becoming, how do we engage people on the other side or create change or get together, and has just become sort of like ego stroking and I don't even know what else.
And what I find annoying as well is where you can't criticize your own side. You can't criticize your own position or your own side without people thinking you're of the other side. And that's just silly. That's just sort of immature, you know, like that's just not the way the world works. So like, for instance, you have like a debate online about, say, cancel culture. You'll have one side saying, well, cancel culture obviously never exists because, you know, all these sort of, I don't know, privileged people who've got columns in newspapers talking about cancel culture, well, obviously cancel culture doesn't exist. And you've got the other side saying, cancel culture dominates everything. You can't say anything anymore in any university or have any opinion without people discrediting you for life. And, you know, I'm more on the side that cancel culture doesn't really exist in a material way. But the desire to cancel people, I think, definitely exists. And to sort of treat people as these sort of disposed, you know, we've got too many people in our lives anyway nowadays in social media. So the desire to sort of call someone out or to say they're cancelled definitely does exist, even if we don't think the actual effects of cancel culture exist. But there's no room for like nuance or middle ground. You know, the word centrist has become such an insult because you've got to have your sort of extreme position somewhere. And the idea of compromise is so unfashionable, you know. And actually, you know, relationships, life, work exists on compromise. That's how human beings haven't quite killed each other totally yet, because we understand that other humans who don't think like us, who've got a different religion to us, who have different values to us, they're just as, you know, they've got just as much right to exist and to think as we have. And we've got to, while we're reacting against something, we've got to just make sure the pendulum doesn't, you know, it's not going at such a velocity, we lose all sense of reason, we become a new type of moralist, a new type of Puritan, that has this ridiculous standards that human beings wouldn't be able to meet. And where you stop seeing someone as human, you know, whoever it is, I struggle with it all the time. You know, I struggle, like if I'm seeing, say, a tweet by, I don't know, a Republican like Ted Cruz or something, I have to actually mentally be mindful and take a distance to actually see, well, this is a person who's actually of your species. So they may have abhorrent views that totally need challenging, but don't, there's a line where you can cross where you're actually putting something out that, even though you're challenging a horrible thing, you're not actually helping challenging it, because you are reducing it to a personal issue or a personal assault, or you're saying something about their looks, you're saying something that's not an actual argument. It's just, you know, I used to do it all the time about, say, in 2016, I'd tweet about, I don't know, something rubbish like Donald Trump's hair or something. It's like, well, you know, stick to what you really, what is the world you're wanting, and how is this helping get to that place? Because is it a world where you're just ridiculing people's looks? I mean, what? So, and also the mental health thing, going back to mental health. And again, I haven't been immune to this myself, but where you will attack someone who's being, I don't know, dodgy white supremacist on one grounds, but the way you'll attack them is stigmatizing in another way. Like you'll say, oh, this person is insane, or you know, they need help, or they need to take their pills, or you'll say something like that. And I see that all the time. So be one foot being progressive and one foot being stigmatizing, or, you know, anti-looks, or, you know, I don't know. So, yeah, I'm just saying we need a bit more patience, a little bit less of throwing in our sort of glass house, throwing stones in glass houses, and to actually realise that we're all flawed human beings. And most of us, even the people we disagree with, I genuinely believe most people feel that they want to be good people. It's just what happens when you get people who want to be good but have a totally different system of how to get there. That's when all the trouble happens. But it doesn't make them evil people. It just means they've got a different roadmap.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Totally. I think that's so true. And it's about how, like you said, you used the word reacting. And I think we're so taught to react at the minute and kind of have an opinion on everything. This is something that I'm trying to stop doing, especially because online people encourage you. And I'm sure you get this all the time, a bit like you were saying earlier, people want you to speak on things. So you kind of feel this obligation to form an opinion and say it right. And sometimes, I either don't have an opinion or I don't have the energy to have an opinion on something, or also my voice isn't actually the best place to have it. And I think that we need to get better at being like, some conversations might take years to come to fruition.
Exactly. I think it's actually dangerous to feel like you have to have an opinion instantly, a sort of ready to go Big Mac Happy Meal opinion that's just there of the moment. It's like, and also, there are so many issues in the world. There are so many important life and death issues. And if you focus on one issue, it's very easy to think everyone should be focused on that issue. So, you know, I suppose aside from mental health, I'm very like, I get very upset and very involved with thinking about the environment, thinking about environmentalism. And there are times when you almost want to shake people and say, why isn't everyone, you know, caring about this issue, which affects us all? But then someone else who's thinking about police brutality, and they're reading article after that, they're following expert after expert, they're reading book after book about that issue, then they'll think, why isn't everybody just focused on this right now? And then there'll be another issue about, I don't know, concentration camps in China. And they say, we need to wake the world up and talk about concentration camps in China. You know, people talk about the Nazis, but concentration camps exist now. Why aren't they caring about that? And it's like, you know, it's literally physically impossible for the human brain to be a perfect advocate about every single important issue going on in the world at one time. And that I notice it, and you probably get it a bit too, when you've got any kind of profile, if someone's got an issue, they almost try and guilt you or pressure you into talking about this issue. And I think, am I the best person to talk about this issue? Am I the best person? You know, I've got literally no knowledge on this issue. You know, will it actually do a cause any good if lots of people are talking about said cause without actually caring about it, but they're talking about it because it's like a moral tax where they feel like they have to pay it to look good and play lip service? I think it's much better where people are sincerely passionate about an issue and a cause that means a lot to them, and they know about it, and they've got a legitimate opinion on it, than to just feel like you have to go through a list of causes that you have to tick a box and say, right, oh, I've done my post about this, I've done my post about that, and you know, I've done my hashtags for the week, and I'm fine. It's better. I think it's better advocacy to actually really get philosophical and think about an issue and think about why you care about something, and to try and see how you can actually change things, whether it's, I don't know, sharing petitions or marching in the street or whatever it is, than to just feel like you've got to have an opinion on every single issue. And it's not to belittle those issues. It's not to even say those issues are less important than the one I'm talking about. It's just like, I'm in a better place to talk about this issue than that. Now, obviously, there are a few things which become moments, Australian bushfires or whatever, where, you know, they dominate schedules, and it's instinctively just happens that you kind of do have an opinion about this issue, even if it's not your issue, because it's there and it's a thing to talk about. But I do also feel like there's a certain pressure that people want you to always talk about their issue, even if it's not your issue. And I feel like we need to understand that there are so many issues in 21st century life, and we can't be advocates for all of them in any effective way.
I completely agree. And it's definitely something that I think, I don't know how we get to that place where we try to understand each other, in the sense that, like, whilst it's this morality idea that people aren't good if they're not sharing something that's going on. And we put so much pressure on people, as you say, to share. At any one moment in time, there might be a million traumas and tragedies going on. But like, as a human, we can't even comprehend those things happening while you're sat in your house in Brighton or whatever it might be. So I think it's that, exactly, going back and kind of looking, actually sitting back and trying to see things as they are, rather than, there's definitely a sense of desperation and really high emotion going on when these things happen, but it is hard to kind of contextualize it in a way that will be, that creates any positive change. I don't know if I've just butchered that. You said it much better than me. I don't know why I'm trying to explain it. Your second thing that you said that you've been wished you taught in school, which I think is a really good one, and I guess kind of actually leads on from that one, is how to cope with adversity. I think this is something we probably all could have done with learning a bit more, but how are you coping with the adversity now, and is there any hot takeaways you can give for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, at school, I had a tough time at school, really. And I feel like there was nothing to equip me, well, through the school years, but also like when I was in my 20s and when I had my breakdown, to equip me for dealing with the stuff of life. You know, every single life, you can think of the happiest person you know, and still in that life, there's going to be grief. There's going to be suffering. There's going to be bad stuff happen. And so much of our life is spent trying to suppress that, or trying to avoid that, or deny that, and not think about death, not think about aging, not think about this. And we suppress all these things, and they come out in other obsessions. So you might be like, someone might be obsessed with sort of looking super young because they don't want to think about mortality or looking at it. And I feel like if we just could accept adversity a bit more as part of life, rather than something we shield children from, we'd actually not end up unhappier. We'd end up happier in a way, because we'd be able to cope with things. You know, there's a famous comparison people make, you know, with Mexico, where they have the Day of the Dead and they go out into the streets and they you know, dress up as skeletons and stuff, and they celebrate and they cry and they howl in the streets about people they've lost in the last year. And it's a day of celebration, and it's a day of mourning, and it's a day of intense human emotion. But we don't have any equivalents of that. So we have these sort of like quiet funerals, and we don't like to think too much about wills or planning. And so I feel like, you know, and it's not just a case of death, obviously adversity, but I feel like we're bad at facing head on the dark parts of life. And I feel very much that in my own experience of mental health, part of the reason I became depressed and had panic disorder and became suicidal was because I was running away from stuff, and running away from suffering, and running away from adversity, and running away from my own mind. And so I would have said I was a happy person, but I wasn't really a happy person before I was ill. I was someone, you know, I was there. I became ill in Ibiza, for instance. I was there like to party, to take drugs, to drink, to smoke, to forget, to listen to loud music, to dance at 4 a.m. And I'm not being judgmental about any of that, but I'm just saying in my own experience, that was because I couldn't stand to be in my own head. I couldn't stand to think about dark stuff. I couldn't stand to think about the sort of depression that was actually building inside me. And so I made it all a lot worse and had a bigger breakdown than I would have done otherwise, because I wasn't facing up to adversity or dealing with it with any way. And now we're in this age of like eternal distraction. So it's less about, often it's less about drinking drugs, but it's always about, you know, we're just placating ourselves with TV or social media or whatever. And I feel like often it's just like pacifying ourselves, and not actually, you know, often putting off problems or issues that we should deal with. So I feel like we should be given more of a toolkit about how to recognize problems. And this is a mental health issue, but it's not just a mental health issue. And how to think about stuff and think about the sort of help we need, and to understand the nature of things. Like, I didn't know when I first had my breakdown that I was experiencing depression or anxiety. I didn't actually know what I was feeling. It felt like I was in this sort of alien body. I was so confused about all this negativity that I had no knowledge of how to get better, because, you know, I hadn't ever thought about my own issues. And so, yeah, I feel like it's getting a bit more emotionally articulate, and to actually not to realize that we're not meant to be, we're not meant to be happy all the time. That might sound bleak, but we're not meant to be happy all the time. And if we try and be happy all the time, we'll actually end up being depressed. You know, if you try and, you know, be happy and drink tequila all the time and dance till the morning sun comes up, then you'll get ill. And that's what happened to me. And I feel like, you know, if we accepted, as the Eastern philosophers and, you know, Buddhism and Taoism and those sort of things, they emphasize that life is actually, part of life is suffering. And it's not to say that life is meant to be this miserable experience and it's absolutely terrible. It's more that saying that the good stuff we have in life, the happiness, the love we have in life, intrinsically part of that is the bad stuff. And you can't, when you try and separate bad and good from each other, something quite nuclear and negative happens. And actually, we're meant to actually experience all things. We're not meant to be happy all the time. We're not meant to be joyful all the time, but we're not meant to be miserable all the time either. And we wouldn't actually know as much happiness as we do if we didn't know suffering and the dark stuff. And I relate this to my own life because I'm actually happier this side of being ill than I ever was before. And I'm happier because of my depression and because of my recovery and because of that, the gratitude that gave me and that appreciation of life in neutral rather than as a sort of intense experience.
That's so lovely to hear. And I guess it sounds like to me, instead of kind of trying to numb yourself from the realities, whether that's the highs and the lows, it's just kind of letting them happen, as it were, which is probably easier said than done. But I had a really similar conversation, actually. I don't know if you know Shona Virtue, who's an amazing like fitness coach and does talks a lot about psychology and things. And when she came on, she also talked, her three things were like meditation, philosophy, and I can't remember the other thing. And she said a lot of similar things to what you're saying. And actually, I came away from that conversation feeling a bit like I do now, like, God, I fill so much time with distraction. So whether that's constantly listening to podcasts, constantly reading, it's like I might not be doing loads of drugs and dancing Ibiza, but I'm certainly not letting myself be in my own head very much of the time. As like a distraction technique.
Yeah, well, we're always distracted by distraction. And I feel like, and now, of course, we've got these forces, or like social media companies, that are, their whole business model is based around our distraction. It's based around us continually clicking and scrolling and liking and sharing. And, you know, I do genuinely like a lot of aspects about social media. I think that's, I think it's great to be able to contact a wide variety of people, to find like-minded people that you wouldn't have been able to find in your physical community around you. I think that's brilliant. I think it's great as a writer, being able to connect with readers and stuff like that. It's great for rallying people around issues and stuff. But I think I think there's something that's fundamentally addictive about social media that is prevents us from seeing the truth of ourselves sometimes. And also the tendency to always present ourselves or to perform a version of ourselves online. I think that it can mess with the truth of yourself sometimes. Even if you're doing it, even if you're overtly, and I do this a lot, I'll sometimes reveal something flawed about myself or an experience of depression I'm feeling, but it still won't quite be the truth. There's still an element of performance about it. You know, there's obviously the performance of like trying to take a really good looking photo of yourself and put that online for likes. But there's another more subtle type of social media use where you're like being superficially honest about your flaws, where, you know, they're real flaws and stuff, but there's still a performance aspect. It's kind of like saying, look at me, how brave I am, talking about my problem with alcohol or this, that, and the other. And this is, I'm just talking about stuff that I've done. I'm not judging anyone else for doing this. But I wonder sometimes if it's actually a barrier to being totally open about your relationship with yourself. And I certainly find it interesting when people, again, and including me in this, talk about former problems with addiction while doing that on social media in their seventh post of a day, and it's just like, have you just switched your addiction to talking about your addiction? So yeah, I mean, obviously there are healthier addictions, and I'm someone who's going to be, you know, I would always, I'd struggle to find an argument to say that Instagram is unhealthier than cocaine. But that said, it's, there still might be something that's, there is a kind of health impact that we're only just starting to wake up to, I think, with social media. And a lot of it has to do with us being distracted away from ourselves. Like, we're sort of losing ourselves a little bit, I think. And I think one of the reasons why things like meditation are so trendy is because we're kind of needing that in the West. We're kind of needing that sense of stillness. It's kind of a counterbalance to all the other stuff that's going on.
I think you're right about, I guess it's like performing vulnerability. And I think that's because it's kind of, I guess, in response to this backlash we've had about the perfect side of social media. Like, we're very clever. I think a lot of it's subconscious, because I definitely do this as well, where I kind of, it's a true vulnerability, yeah, but I've kind of stored it up and packaged it and then I'm putting it online. So it's not like, it's not instantaneous. So yeah, there has to be, as you said, some level of premeditation about the fact that it's being shared.
Yeah, no, and that's totally understandable, because it would be an absolute mess if we just literally sort of did our primal scream selves, like when we're literally like blubbering in the bathroom and just like a total mess, and oh God, you hate me, no. And it's just, yeah, but obviously that'd just be toxic to put all of that out there. So we all do it, but it's just like when it gets to a point where you're doing it quite a lot. Like, and I was doing it certainly after Reasons to Stay Alive a lot, where I'd be revealing all, I'd get a kind of thrill out of revealing stuff, and it would be for impact value. And I sort of wonder, you know, but there's no clear answer to this, because obviously it's good to be honest. And I think part of human beings' problems is that we're a very clandestine species, you know, like famously we're one of the only species that has sex behind closed doors. We go to the toilet behind closed doors. We're as animals go, we're kind of like a secretive species. We're very self-conscious. We're one of the few animals that blush. We're very coy. We wear clothes, and we're not a normal kind of animal in that sense. But I feel like anything that breaks through that and reveals stuff that's kind of true, that helps other people accept their own flaws and accept their own issues they have around stuff. And that's all good. But I feel like on a personal level, when it's you putting that stuff out there a lot, there's a risk that of becoming a brand of your own flaws, becoming a brand, like in my case, becoming like Mr. Depression. And everything becoming like, oh, you are the depression person, and this and the other. And then it can become defining in an unhealthy way, because the key thing that helped me like in recovery was becoming completely open in a way that I hadn't been before, being prepared to become a slightly different type of person, being a kind of man who's okay about being a bit thin-skinned or a bit weak or a bit this, that, and the other. Whereas, you know, as a young man, I'd been like, oh yeah, you know, my thing was that I could drink lots of alcohol and not be drunk. And I was used to be really proud of that as a young man. It sounds so pathetic to admit it, but that was my thing. I was like, you know, being a man was taking a lot and just not showing it. That was what being a man was. And then I had to radically change my personality in a way. I had to be open to a new version of me. And I suppose what I'm saying is social media can make you become a brand of yourself, whatever level you are, whatever platform. You could have like 50 Facebook friends, whatever scale. We all become kind of like magazines of ourselves, where you're putting out a version which you think other people expect of you. And obviously that was always the case. You know, human beings have always dressed up, have always spoken a certain way to certain people. That's not new. But I think social media, the way it exploits that for these businesses can be a bit unhealthy, because like sometimes I'll think, you know, people, like I notice on Instagram now, people expect a certain type of message from your output. And then you'll see it yourself, because you'll think, oh, when I say this sort of thing, that's more popular. If I reveal this side of me, that's more popular than when I reveal this other side of me. So there's a risk that you end up, if you spend a lot of time on social media, suppressing one entire side, a quite important side of your personality, to just focus on this other side of your personality. And there's a risk then that you're not quite being a true self. And then when that other personality rears yourself, people will be like, what's up with him? Why is he saying that? What's that? And it's just like, well, that's all part of my, you know, my thing. And I try and actively, when I'm on social media now, I sometimes try and say something that's deliberately not what's expected of me, you know, to almost rebel against that instinct. But I mean, it's still a different kind of performance. But yeah, I don't know the answer. But I feel basically we're probably all spending too much time on social media, and I certainly am. But I am a lot happier about Twitter. That's one thing I've scientifically worked out about my brain.
I think you're right in what you're saying then. It's so flattening. I definitely experienced this. And it is because of that concept of branding and marketing. And it's like you're so much more easily packageable if Matt Haig is just the depression man. Great, next. Do you know what I mean? Like that's perfect for capitalism in terms of how people can wrap you up and buy you. And it's really frustrating to have to think, oh God, they're actually a really complex human being who might have a different view of me about this. But this actually goes on quite well to your very last thing you wish you'd been taught in school, which is self-acceptance. And I mean, that's a really difficult one, but how are you getting on with that now?
I still struggle with it. I'm a total work in progress on this. Self-acceptance, you know, for instance, I'm a man, obviously, but I used to really struggle with looks issues and what I look like when I was a young person. I'm a middle-aged person now. I'm 45, but when I was a young teenager and 20 something person, to give you an example, I still have a mole on my face, but I don't even notice the mole on my face now. But when I was a kid, there was this girl I fancied at school, and she said to me on school playing field, and should have forgotten it that same evening, but she said, oh yeah, don't sit next to me, I don't like that mole on your face. And like that just stuck in my head for so long. And I went home that night and I took a toothbrush and I tried to create a scar on my face by trying to rub out the mole on my face. And because I thought, well, a scar would at least look tough. And obviously there's no science behind that. You can't rub out a mole on your face by doing that. And I used to have all kinds of like things that I feel so sorry for my younger self when I was so bothered. I thought I was so ugly, and you look back at photos of that time, as everyone does, and think, "What was I? What was my issue with myself? I look great then," and we, you know, and all of that, and it. I just wish, you know, going back to school, I wish there'd been someone or some teacher who could have explained to me about self-acceptance and about how ridiculous it is. And you know, even going into adulthood, and I know this is a pressure women have faced historically far more, and even in the present far more than men, but you see it happening. I see it happening with men too now, you know, about certainly with gym culture and that whole bro culture of like being muscly and being, you know, having to do to how much do you lift and all of that culture. And I used to be obsessed with like doing a certain amount of press-ups a day or this, that and the other. And it wasn't about fitness, you know. I pretend it was about fitness. I'd used to buy, say, Men's Health and pretend it was about fitness, but it was about the opposite of fitness. It was about being slightly mentally ill and feeling like I had to look a certain way. But it's not the fault of the individual. We live in this society where we're encouraged to feel like whoever we are. You know, yes, this is a pressure women feel, but all human beings are encouraged to feel in a capitalist society, I think, to feel like we kind of lack something. And the reason we're encouraged to feel like that is because unless we feel like we lack something, we're not going to be out there buying something. We're not going to be out there buying beauty creams or gym memberships if we felt 100% as satisfied with ourselves as we're satisfied with a newborn baby. And wouldn't it be like the most beautiful thing in the world if, you know, that feeling you have when you see a newborn baby and you see them as a total entity? You don't see a lack. You don't see a problem with their looks. You don't see they haven't got enough money. We don't see they haven't got enough social media followers or status. And we just see their entire human worth as a complete finished thing of humanity. And wouldn't it be great if we could have a true sort of self-acceptance and self-love and see ourselves always as that sort of baby and, you know, really just have that intrinsic sense of worth. And yes, we'd still strive for things and want to fulfill dreams and have forward momentum and all that stuff. But it wouldn't be a case that, oh, if we don't achieve X, Y, or Z, then we've totally failed as a person. It's this idea, you know, and this isn't about looks anymore. It's just about, like, you know, my problem now is about work. I feel like if I put my foot on the brake with work, if I stop working, then my worth will go down. You know, I've always got to have a book on the go. I've written something stupid like 20 books in less than 20 years, and it's kind of too much. And I realized recently it was because I feel like if I don't work, then I will lose a sense of my own value and identity. And you know that slogan, you know, the Nike slogan everyone used to, like, just do it. I feel like that became the whole mantra of Western society, like, just do it. Like, we're in a world of doing and productivity and, you know, the antithesis of the Eastern view of being. You know, we've got this idea that we have to just do. And sometimes it's okay to just be. And, you know, if we can just accept ourselves in the moment, we don't have to actually work out ourselves into value. We don't have to work ourselves into value. We don't have to make ourselves, beautify ourselves into value. We're actually valuable because we're here as this amazing life form on this amazing, rare, tender planet that we're on. And this craving continually to do, it's bad for us, it's bad for the planet, it's bad for the environment. And wouldn't it be nice to just sort of step off that train?
Wow, that was such a good answer to that. And there's so many things I want to say to that. I mean, first of all, I think you're definitely right in that obviously women face huge pressures about what they look like. But I think more and more, especially, it's really important to hear men talking about that. I just don't think it's something that's spoken about enough. It's sort of like a given that guys go to the gym, and no one ever necessarily interrogates men's relationship with their bodies or food in the same way that we might see red flags with young girls. And now that I'm older, I even look back and think, actually, some of my guy friends at school really were quite obsessive about food or the gym. And we don't seem to always necessarily clock that men can have those same insecurities. And I think that's really important to be spoken about, because it's definitely, as you say, like, getting worse, especially with, you know, shows and the way that bodies on Instagram are heralded and all of that kind of stuff. But what you said about self and work, I mean, I completely relate to that. I think a lot of people do now. I kind of feel like my career is my identity. I don't really know who I am when I'm not doing work. I always say, like, oh, I want to take a big break between the podcasts. And then when I'm in between seasons, I suddenly think, like, what is the point of me? Which is obscene, because obviously I'm loads of things apart from a podcaster. But it's really hard to find your worth outside of that. I don't know if you've read, I recently read, I keep talking about it because it's so good, Utopia for Realists by Rutger Bregman. And he talks about
read that. It's brilliant.
Oh my God. It's such a good book. And the bit that I love was the talk about the need for leisure, that we've completely lost the ability to just enjoy things for the sake of it. Like, everything becomes work. Everything becomes commodified. Yeah. We don't actually know how to not work. It's almost like inconceivable to us to do something for no reason.
Yeah. No, totally. And I feel also, it's totally counterproductive. Even if we've got this aim to be productive, when I'm in that deep work state of, like, work addiction, I'm not actually being very creative. You kind of need to value rest. You know, rest is an important part of work. You know, I never get a good novel idea when I'm staring at a Word document and I'm just staring at the arctic blankness of that white page and just trying to think of an idea. And, like, I'm in that mode at the moment, actually, where I'm trying to come up with a new novel idea. And you can't do it by just pressurizing yourself. You have to sort of, like, step away, go for a walk in the sunshine, you know. Often you get an idea in the shower or when you're walking the dog or when you're, like, not thinking of work, you actually get the best work done. So it's also about understanding that, you know, life isn't, I feel like there's something slightly masochistic in our work culture, where it hasn't just got, it's not just about being productive and producing stuff, but it's got to feel hard. It's got to feel a bit difficult. And like we're not, it's not properly work unless it feels hard. And I think that's really interesting psychologically why we need that. And why we can't just accept ourselves as we are. But you're right. That's a great book. Utopia for Realists. That's brilliant.
On a last thing, because I know you've been in for ages, but something I've been thinking about lately, because I've been trying to, after reading that book, I'm like, right, I'm going to take up painting, I'm going to make jewellery, and I'm going to do it all with no intention of it being anything apart from kind of like play. And it made me realise that as a child, everyone used to call me creative because I was constantly coming up with ideas. And I used to dream about being an author when I was little, because I was like, how could you ever stop coming up with things to write about? My God, my brain is just full of ideas. And then you've turned into this adult who's all your life kind of been told you're creative. I don't know if it's the same for you, but I imagine it maybe was. And suddenly you're like so stifled because your life is so crammed full of things that aren't play, which inherently don't seem to produce creativity. And it's also counterproductive, like you just said. It's like it has to be a struggle when actually some of the best ideas are born out of boredom normally, I would imagine.
Yeah, or staring out the window. And I sometimes worry actually about my own kids that they don't have enough sort of staring out the window time, because they've always plugged into something, or they're on my Xbox, or they're watching a film in the back of the car. But what I learn a lot from my children. I've got like an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, and I learn how naturally creative they are. And when they're most creative, it's not when they're sort of leaning over their textbooks, it's when they're actually messing around. And you know, my son Lucas, when he was 7, he actually gave me one of my novel ideas, and it was just a question he had in bed. You know, his question was, what was Father Christmas like as a boy? And then I didn't have an answer to give him, a ready answer. So I went away and wrote a book about Father Christmas as a boy, an origin story, a secular sort of origin story of Father Christmas. And that's now a film. And he's in that film. I'm just showing off there. But that's coming out this year. But yeah, that was just a totally, we need randomness in life. We need just sort of like to follow our own minds a bit more, and not to always fit into sort of some other ideas, someone else's idea of what sort of hard work is, or what to do. I mean, I think in some ways we're at, it could be a potentially very creative time. You know, I think young people now are more aware of options than when I was, say, sort of like 20. I had, there's a bigger world of options out there. You can have your own podcast, you can write your own books, you can create your own, brand of smoothie or whatever. There's a million opportunities out there in the world. But the trouble is, we're almost, I think, paralyzed by choice. I can't remember which horrible mega brand, there was a sort of some big, horrible corporate mega brand who did an experiment on customer choice. I think it was someone like Unilever. And they had, I'll just end on this little anecdote. They had this experiment where they had two sections of the supermarket, which they took over. And one section, they had just three brands of shampoo and conditioner on offer. And then on another section, they had all their brands in the of shampoo and conditioner on offer. So they had like 47 different conditioners and shampoos. They had their sort of like shampoos for every different type of hair type and everything. And far more, they sold far more shampoo and conditioner on the aisle where they only had a choice of three than on the one where they had a choice of 47 different types of shampoo and conditioner. So the point to that little anecdote is that when we are overwhelmed with choice, we get less done. We're less likely to buy the thing or do the thing or create the thing. And now we're so swamped with our lives. I think often the most creative thing and the most work-minded thing isn't to add something new into the mix. It's to take it away, to treat ourselves like a first draft that we're editing, and to get rid of some of the clutter. You know, when you're writing a novel, the easiest way to make it better is to take stuff out, not to add stuff in. So it's about finding the bare bones of us again, I think, in life. And I feel like the problem of modern existence is a problem of too much. And that's an environmental problem, but it's also a psychological problem. And I think the answer is very much about stripping back and seeing the bare bones of who we are.
Sorry, I'm just going to ruin that, you finishing on such a beautiful note. Because just through saying that, I just realised that I probably watched more films when we used to get videos from Blockbusters than I ever do now that I have Netflix, because I simply can't pick. So I just don't really watch movies anymore.
Yeah,
because it's too hard to choose.
No, well, it's a, well, I mean, Netflix, I mean, I can't say bad things about Netflix because my film is coming out with Netflix later this year, but Netflix, we've got, there's a lot of choice. I feel like, you know, it's not good. Well, it's like when you're watching CNN or something, you're like, which news should I be concentrating on? Should I be concentrating on the news that's running across the screen at the bottom, or what's coming out of the mouth, or what's happening in the top right of the screen? And it's like, we're all like these computers with so many frames open. It's like we've got, like, you know, that stupid rainbow wheel that goes when you've got too much going on your laptop. We've got this sort of like rainbow wheel inside ourselves where we're not getting anything done because we've got too much open and too much happening. And I'm all for, you know, being these sort of multi-hyphenate, multi-talented people, Renaissance people with doing different things all at once. But we can't do everything all the time. And sometimes it's nice to just strip it all back and just to think, right, okay, what am I here for? What have I got to offer the world? What am I interested in? What's going to make me happy? And go with that and not be totally drowned out with all these other voices and expectations and distractions.
I completely agree. Thank you so much for joining me. I've honestly loved this conversation. I'm sorry to have kept you longer than planned, but I feel like I could honestly chat to you all day long.
Well, thanks for putting up with my waffle today. I was waffling on, but no, you're very easy to talk to. So thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
It's been such a pleasure. If anyone wants to find you, or if you've got anything else you want to point us in the direction towards that's exciting and new or anything like that.
Well, I definitely wouldn't follow me on Twitter because I'm sort of non-existent on Twitter anymore. My only real social media, if you wanted to follow me, is Matt Haig. I'm on Instagram. It's actually Matt Z Haig on Instagram. When I was 8 years old, I was really hated being called Matthew because my sister was called Phoebe. And this was before Friends. And Phoebe used to be a really unusual name. So I wanted an unusual name too because there was five other boys in my class called Matthew. So I went to my grandfather's family tree. And in the 1700s, there was a member of my family called Zerubbabel, which is an old sort of biblical name. And so I thought, okay, I'll be Matthew Zerubbabel Haig. So on Instagram, I'm Matt Z Haig. And you didn't ask for all that information, but there, I've just given you some necessary biographical insights to my own weird 8-year old self.
That's actually probably a name more unusual than mine, which I don't normally hear, to be honest, because mine's also a bit odd and wild. But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.